States Court of Appeals in and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as this court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Roger Wetmore's Automotive Services against Del Rey. Mr. Durkin.
May it please the court, counsel. As some of you may know, I have never had the luxury of arguing a civil case before.
I was about to remark on that. I said, I don't mind seeing your face, but in a civil case, it's kind of shy.
On the other hand, I've argued a few RICO cases from a different perspective. So,
if you stumble, we'll understand.
I'm either the right guy or the wrong guy to be arguing this. But just as an explanation, my involvement in this case in the district court began subsequent to Judge Jerry Hagan's order when there was litigation over attorney's fees. That litigation is still ensuing, and that's when I became involved. So I am not as familiar with all the facts and the nuances of the pleadings in the district court, but I am very familiar with Judge Jerry Hagan's order, and that's how I would like to address you primarily today. I was somewhat taken aback from the beginning in this case when I reviewed the order and thought I was reading what really sounded more to me like a memorandum opinion in support of a bench trial. I think that it is abundantly clear from this order that Judge Derjahagian weighed evidence and drew inferences from the facts, which, if I understand correctly, is simply not the task of someone finding for summary judgment. The other thing I was struck with was the difference. There are two orders of Judge Gottschall's that are attached in the appendix, one of May 8, 2002, and the other of December 16, 2002. And if you read those opinions, even if there are some deficiencies in some of the pleadings, I think you can see the difference between her analysis, particularly as it pertains to the Hobbs Act, which I think is the biggest failing that Judge Derjahagian made in his opinion. I think as a general rule, what I would say Judge Derjahagian did incorrectly, which I think is fatal to his ruling, is that he misapplied or misunderstood the reasonable trier of fact standard and instead inserted a reasonable person standard for the Hobbs Act counts. And I don't think that the statute requires any such reasonable person. There are at least four.
Well, I understand that to mean that reasonable jurors are not reasonable people, or
no? I think it's a different question. There is no reasonable person standard. that I'm aware of in the Hobbs Act.
Well, I want to know the distinction between a reasonable person and a reasonable juror.
A reasonable juror can make findings, but as with respect, at least by my way of looking at this, with respect to the issue of whether there was a material fact for a jury to decide, there were issues presented from the evidence that could go either way. There was, as Judge Gottschall pointed out.
What you're simply saying is that there's a fact that has to be taken into consideration.
Absolutely.
By a jury, not by a judge.
That's right. At least if I understand summary judgment correctly.
Yeah, well, that, you've got that right on the head. So
because what I'm concerned with is that in numerous occasions, Judge Derryhagian simply says he implies a reasonable person standard, which simply doesn't exist under the law. If you look at his analysis of the Illinois intimidation statute in page 8 of his order, Judge Derryhagian says, in this case, there's insufficient evidence for a reasonable trier of fact to conclude that if any of the defendants engaged in conduct or participated in a conspiracy aimed at conduct that constituted a threat or could be deemed a threat by a reasonable person to intimidate. Now, there was substantial evidence in this record, and I won't belabor it, with respect to evidence of people feeling as though they were intimidated, particularly the plaintiff. His deposition is replete with evidence with respect to his being intimidated. Now, a jury could conclude that's not sufficient evidence, or it could conclude some other fact, or that simply conclude it wasn't credible. But at this stage of the proceeding, applying a reasonable person standard there is simply wrong. I envision myself at times in this case feeling as though I were arguing a motion for a judgment of acquittal at the close of the government's evidence. I've argued less. I've had the same facts in a criminal case where the case has to go to the jury for that very reason, where the district court simply cannot impose its decision as to whether or not it believes that evidence is credible. That's a factual determination, and there are.
What you're saying is you could not have directed a verdict, assuming the truth of everything here.
That's
you,
what I'm saying.
Okay.
Exactly what I'm saying.
How do you take this language out of his order? It says, plaintiffs have offered no evidence that Del Rey or anyone acting on behalf of Del Rey demanded money from anyone.
I take that as weighing the evidence, because what he's read out of the Hobbs Act completely is the color official right extortion. He's read that right out.
That would mean any time a policeman came into a place to sell a ticket, the Hobbs Act would kick into effect.
No, not necessarily, but it could. The mental state of the payor is relevant with respect to Hobbs Act extortion.
No matter how unreasonable.
Right.
No matter how unreasonable.
No. If that were the only piece of evidence in this case, I'd agree.
But if the subjective belief of the person buying the ticket is the total predicate for the whole thing, then what you're really suggesting is a matter of law, police officers, deputy sheriffs should not sell tickets.
That's a policy issue that I don't want to touch.
Yeah.
I think it might be a good idea. But I can tell you, though, that I have...
Shouldn't be a crime, should it?
It depends. That fact standing alone, if that were the only piece of evidence, if the only evidence in this case was that a sheriff came into my dealership or my towing truck place with a gun on and asked to sell a ticket, then I wouldn't be here arguing. But there is, this is, you have to put this in the context of
really
the conspiracy.
About it, what he's beefing about, though, Mr. Durkin, is that he didn't get his share of the towing.
He is beefing about he didn't get his share of the towing.
Not that he was intimidated.
I think the beef about his share of the towing goes more to the retaliation for his constitutional claim, that he's saying in that count, counts 7 and 8, I think, he's saying that I expressed a First Amendment opinion in supporting the other person, and I got retaliated against. What I think he's saying, and I think it's clear, well, maybe not crystal clear, but what he's saying in the Hobbs Act conspiracy count and the RICO conspiracy is that there is evidence that I was extorted under color official right and under the Illinois bribery statute and the Illinois intimidation statute. There is evidence of a conspiracy to extort under color official right in order to maintain the towing. And the evidence that I think is pretty substantial, and again, I think this is another example of Judge Derhagian weighing the evidence and not giving us every inference of the doubt, is that he argues against that. One of the strongest pieces of evidence here, I think, is the fact that they were able to demonstrate that the annual towing over the previous several years had been $114,000 per year. It was cut down to $54,000. After the events that they complain about. Judge Derhagian, on the contrary, instead of just accepting that in the plaintiff's favor, as I understand he must do, Judge Derhagian instead says that's evidence that there was no retaliation and therefore the sheriff was acting in good faith because he says, and this is, I think, weighing the evidence in its extreme, he could have cut him out completely instead of just cutting half of his business. I think that's just an improper inference.
What about when a lawyer makes a contribution to a judicial campaign?
Topic close to my heart.
Yes. And the lawyer feels intimidated and pays the money and then he loses the case 2 weeks later.
Again, it becomes
a question of fact.
It becomes a question of fact, and it's a question of a quid pro quo. I agree that these are hard cases to prove. But what I'm most troubled by, and maybe this is not my place to be saying, but I'll say it anyway. It seems to me that this court tends to be much more expansive in a criminal setting than it is in a civil setting. I have argued cases in the district courts where the evidence simply was campaign contributions, where the government indicted for campaign contributions and relied on the subjective intent of the donors, which the law permits them to do.
But that is when he misuses the campaign contribution instead of using it for the political thing, which is the subjective opinion of the donor. He uses it for personal matters, which is nothing.
No, on the contrary. With all due respect, Judge, I had a case recently in the Northern District of Indiana where the government charged a criminal case for the solicitation of tickets and where there was retaliation by the clerk. And again, the case boiled down to a quid pro quo. Could you say that simply, and that's the other point I wanted to make that Judge Derhagian, I think, misses severely here. Quid pro quo doesn't write out bribery or extortion in a campaign contribution setting. Allen, the case they refer to, makes that clear. I'm very familiar with Allen. I argued Allen. I filed a petition for certiorari on Allen. There's no doubt that you can have Hobbs Act extortion or bribery with respect to campaign contributions. The only limitation McCormick played.
I agree. You don't have to argue that point.
But I'm not sure that Judge Derhagian agrees with you, because if you look at what he says here, he reads it right out. If you go to page 6 of the opinion, he says,
you know, we're not reviewing the district judge's opinion. We're reviewing the judgment.
I understand.
But we're not going to mark it or grade it or anything like that. You really have to argue the merits and not
But the merits, Judge.
What the district court
said. I'm arguing to you that the district court implied the wrong standard, that the district court weighed the evidence, did not give the plaintiff the benefit of the factual inferences that were there.
Yeah, but the question I'm making is, are you going to make an argument that on this record the correct understanding is favorable to your client?
Yes, sir.
So far, you've just said you disagree with the district judge's opinion. You haven't explained why, in your view, you're entitled to prevail.
Because there was ample evidence to show a material question of fact. There was
That's just the legal standard. You might want to.
There were a number of instances. First, where the plaintiff himself testified to his motivations for making the $250 contribution. There were repeated, and it's set forth pretty thoroughly from pages 12 to 15 of the brief. There was testimony that, if you were reluctant, I was just afraid to. There was the evidence.
You will find, perhaps, that some of us are as reluctant as the district judge to think that a donor's subjective intent, divorced from any objective indicators, is important.
Okay.
What are the objective indicators that, in your view, demonstrate the existence of extortion?
The payments to the other people, the payments that the other people made, the fact that one of those people never had towing before, got towing because he
Is there, for example, a statistical analysis of the way in which towing assignments were changed after prior elections and how that correlates with campaign contributions?
Well, what we showed you was that only like 0.042% of his contributions came from the population, but 13% of his money came from towing operators. A substantial portion of his money came from that. There was
How about my question? Is there an analysis of the way in which towing territories were changed after prior elections, and comparing that with
There is no such analysis as that.
But without that, it makes it very hard to understand objectively how a person would have responded to these solicitations. If there isn't a history of changing the towing territories of people who don't support you,
but there was,
then objectively, it's hard to see where the fist behind the glove is.
Well, there was evidence, and I thought this was a strong piece of evidence. The sheriff testified that he never made personal visits, and yet the evidence fully demonstrated that he did make personal visits. That he was left with people. Several other people testified to giving money under those circumstances, reluctantly, and I think that there was a pattern. I'm simply saying you may be reluctant to go there, but I think the law requires you to go there, and that I don't think in summary judgment the district court could simply weigh the evidence the way it did and not let those facts go to the jury. I see that my time is up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Durkin.
Thank you.
Mr. Field.
Good morning, counsel. I believe that the court really is right on point, and what I infer from what I just heard, that the plaintiff's own subjective intent cannot dictate that this case go to a jury. He testifies that since the late 70s, he's had people bearing sidearms and badges coming into his garage and asking him for money, and now all of a sudden in 1998 this becomes a shakedown, whereas it didn't seem to be before.
No, before he said that he got his share of the towing, so everything worked out. He said before he always got his share of the towing, but after this one he didn't.
Which is a nice segue into his argument that he's the victim of retaliation. However, you have to look at the facts of the record here. The purported retaliation occurred 13 months after what he claims is protected conduct. And then you must also consider the motives that he gave at his deposition for making the contribution to Willie Smith. He thought that he would benefit financially from that.
He thought he was bribing.
I'm sorry?
He thought he was bribing.
In a sense, yes. Hmm. Yes, and in a sense...
Maybe just buying insurance.
As Judge Daryagian pointed out, in contributing to Willie Smith, he was doing what he claims that the defendants and the other towers were doing when looked at from the opposite side of the room.
It's not clear how that helps your client. One way to read that is that everybody thinks that there is a culture of political rewards for political contributions in Lake County.
Or every place else, for that matter.
Yeah. And, of course, before O'Hare Truck Service, people thought that was proper. O'Hare Truck Service holds that it's not. And in Lake County, it continues. And that's the basic allegation here.
The fact that
the plaintiff was playing the game doesn't disqualify him from bringing a lawsuit.
It certainly doesn't.
And if that was indeed the game, then under the Supreme Court's precedent, there's a serious problem here.
Well, once he brings the lawsuit, however, then he has to articulate facts which supports his position. And in this case, he doesn't. There's no evidence that any of these towers were actually intimidated. There's no evidence that any of them...
Put RICO to one side. If this is just a 1983 suit under O'Hare Truck Service, nobody has to be intimidated. The only claim is that there was political support, that there was a change in towing services in response to political support, QED. That's all the Supreme Court requires.
Well, if this is simply a 1983 case, then he has to allege facts, or he has to...
You don't have to allege facts. This, of course, is summary judgment.
At the summary judgment stage, he has to have facts which establish in the first instance that his conduct was protected. And I believe that under the precedent of the circuit, he's not done so. He had a purely private motive.
I don't think you want to try to make the argument that political campaign contributions and political support are not protected under the First Amendment. You must have better arguments than that.
Well, I believe that under the precedent, that argument is sufficient. He testified that he had no opinion as to whether or not Willie Smith or Gary Delway was the better law enforcement officer. He testified that he had been tipped that a competitor was trying to deprive him of towing and trying to deprive him of engaging, or rather obtaining an expanded area as opposed to a reduced area, and that motivated his support for the other candidate. When that candidate lost, then he once again contributed to Del Rey. And now he's arguing that he's the victim of political retaliation. I simply don't think that under the precedent of the circuit that argument can be supported on the facts of this case. And another thing I'd point out as sort of an aside, since we're talking about the facts of the case, I think we also have to look at it in the context of what the plaintiff's compliance with the district court's Rule 56.1, where that dictates what the facts of the case are in the summary judgment setting. And the plaintiff failed substantially to comply with the dictates of that rule, and I believe that this court must consider that in determining whether or not Judge Derjagian made factual decisions or, in effect, supplanted the role of a jury in making his decision in favor of the defendant. Many of the plaintiff's responses to the factual allegations of the defendant in the Rule 56.1 statement were simply, we object, the record doesn't support it. There's no allegation of specific facts on behalf of the plaintiff which would be sufficient to create an issue of fact that has to go to trial. And that can't be lost on this panel, I think, in determining whether or not the judgment, as opposed to the reasoning for it, is appropriate in this case.
You disagree that there were, for example, in the solicitation differences between the rendition of the version of facts, yours and the other side? Did the uniformed deputies go and make collections on behalf of...
In this particular year, no. That was a historical allegation. In this particular year, and by the way, keep in mind, Sheriff Del Rey was appointed to fill a vacancy 2 years earlier, so he is not the historical figure that had been in the office during all these years that Mr. Whitmore testified to in his deposition. But in this year, the facts are that Sheriff Del Rey had been in office 2 years. He was appointed. He'd never been elected. A couple of the towers wanted to increase his familiarity, if you will, with people in the western part of the county, so they volunteered to take him out and introduce him to some people, which they did. That's all that the record in this case contains. There's no evidence of any uniformed deputies going into any towing contractors and soliciting funds, shaking them down for funds, or however one cares to characterize it.
So your point is that the testimony with regard to that occurring didn't happen during Del Rey's tenure or leases.
Exactly. Mr. Whitmore testified to that as being a sort of anecdotal, historical type of thing to support his conclusion that this 1 year that he gives money to the opponent, he suffered retaliation.
You finished?
unless there are other questions.
See, if you're finished, we have, so.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Field. Anything further, Mr. Durkin? Got a little less than a minute.
Talk fast.
I think that the evidence with respect to the sheriff and the undersheriff coming out is more forceful, frankly, than the evidence with respect to the sheriffs with the guns. There was no evidence of the uniform sheriffs during Del Rey's term, but just the contrary, which I think is more damaging and certainly more inferential of corroborating the entire scheme, is the fact that the sheriff and the undersheriff himself went out and visited people, and they all said that they paid. They were left alone with them after the introduction, and then the contributions get made. Kohlmeyer says, why did he do that? He says, because it might have had an adverse aspect. It helped. The contributions help, I'm sure. Herman says, was the towing operators a good candidate to contribute? He said, yes, because they did business with the sheriff's office, I think.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.